This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to Bloomberg Government's Capital Impact on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. My name is Alan Scott. This is the place where government actions come face-to-face with business decisions. Online at www.bgov.com and, of course, on the air right here on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. And the Affordable Care Act is one of the things we're discussing this morning. Has lots of layers, which is why it's going to take many years to complete the entire rollout. One program, which has actually been around for a little while now, is getting kind of rolled into this whole Affordable Care Act thing and getting a sort of an enhancement as the number of facilities eligible for benefits has nearly tripled from 2005 to 2011. I pause and say, this is a good thing, right? Well, someone who can answer that question is senior healthcare analyst Brian Rye, who's written the 340B conundrum, Affordable Care Act shrinks ranks of uninsured, boosts drug discount program for hospitals serving them. And he joins me now. How are you?
I'm good, Alan. Thanks for having me.
Well, thanks for being here. I'm kind of hesitant to say that this is a good thing. I don't know. I think it is a good thing for those who are in need, but for the pharmaceutical companies, I'm saying, I don't know. I'm not sure. And this is a perfect business impact of a government action. It brings to light exactly what we're here for.
It is. And you know, as you said, we titled it the 340B conundrum because right. It is sort of a puzzle. What we're talking about is a drug discount program where the law requires pharmaceutical companies to give safety net hospitals that serve disproportionately large numbers of uninsured and low-income Americans to give them discounts on the purchase of drugs. And what happens is the hospital, you know, will buy the drugs at a discount, you know, which is at least 23% now, and then will turn around and bill the patient's insurance program for the full price. They'll make money on the spread. And it can be significant. You know, as an example, the Duke University hospital system down in North Carolina in 2012 made $48 million with this program. And the idea is that the hospital will then use these proceeds to provide more services for those poor and uninsured folks, whether giving them their own discounts on drugs or providing services and buying up equipment that they wouldn't otherwise be able to, given the types of populations that they serve. I think from the drug company's perspective, that's fine in theory, but as you noted, this program has grown significantly.
Yeah, I mean, it's made leaps and bounds since 2005.
It has. The GAO, in a report calling for more oversight of this program, noted that it tripled from 2005 to 2011, and about a third of all U.S. hospitals now participate. And some concerns are that, you know, there's a very vague definition of who an eligible patient is, and so we've had a situation where some of these safety net hospitals have been encouraged to maybe partner with prisons, you know, and if you can get those prisoners to be considered patients, you capture more of the spread. You're also getting more incentives to acquire oncology practices if you're a hospital. And if you bring those practices in-house, you get the spreads on these lucrative, you know, and expensive cancer drugs.
Okay, my jaw just dropped when you said prisons because I didn't even think about that. That's a gigantic population, a contract of sorts, that a gigantic population of people are now going to get the rewards of a program that was intended not just for, well, they're going to reap the rewards of it, but for people who are underinsured or uninsured. Is this a case of, say, the first one's free kind of deal?
You know, it could be. I think it's a case of unintended consequences, and it may be, you know, a program growing beyond its very well-intentioned initial means. You know, I think what's happened is these same hospitals are facing significant cuts for other reimbursement under the Affordable Care Act, and so this is sort of a way to counterbalance that. And they are looking for ways to both expand their patient population and to qualify. Now, one of the things we talked about the Affordable Care Act, you would think that as you shift patients, as the Medicaid expansion happens and you shift patients from being uninsured to being covered by Medicaid, that would reduce the need for this program. It actually does. It actually makes it easier for these patients or for these hospitals to qualify for the program. And that's because the formula has nothing to do with how many uninsured patients you have, but it does make it easier if you have more Medicaid patients. And so we have a bit of a paradox that the Affordable Care Act is highlighting. The other thing the Affordable Care Act did is it increased the minimum discount from 15% to 23%. And so these drug companies, you know, it used to be sort of an annoyance. With all these factors, it's becoming more and more of a problem. And I think they're getting, their voices are becoming louder and louder here in Washington, D.C. as they try and get the attention of Congress.
Hospitals that are now qualifying for this, if they're publicly owned hospitals or privately held hospitals, or independently owned, I should say, independently owned hospitals. I take, for example, Jersey City Medical Center up in New Jersey. I spoke to Joseph Scott, who's the CEO up there, president, and the whole deal. He was rueing the day that the Affordable Care Act was ever invented because he's in an inner city area where a lot of the people there are not insured. They have nothing. So they get tax benefits, major tax benefits to handle the population there gratis. Mm-hmm. Things are changing now, so much so they were just acquired by another company to roll them in. Hey, come on, welcome to the family. We'll take care of you now. The amount of money they were going to bring in was going to change dramatically once this plan was rolled out.
I think, you know, this wouldn't be a problem as these patients shift from being uninsured onto Medicaid if Medicaid was a good payer for these facilities.
So that's the difference.
But in fact, it's not.
Okay, therein lies the difference.
And so, you know, comparing an Aetna or a Blue Cross Blue Shield to Medicaid, Medicaid, I think, pays about a third less. And so from the hospital's perspective, there's still a very good need for this 340B program because shifting patients from being uninsured to Medicaid, simply you're going from bad to slightly less bad.
Sad to say, but that's the state of affairs that we're in today. You're listening to Bloomberg Government's Capital Impact on Federal News Radio 1500 AM, where we're discussing the 340B conundrum. Affordable Care Act shrinks ranks of uninsured, boosts drug discount program for hospitals serving them. Let's talk about how a patient, let's talk about the qualifying criteria for a patient. Key determinant for eligibility for the safety net hospitals. What is the magic number that we're looking for?
You know, it's very loosely defined. And that's one of the things that the GAO has sort of stressed, and even the safety net hospitals have been on board with additional clarity for this patient population. I should say that the agency that has oversight of this program is a small one, HRSA, within the Department of HHS. But it's very loosely defined. You know, the entity, you know, must have a, quote, established relationship, you know, with individuals such that they maintain records of that individual's health care. They need to receive care. These people need to receive care from an individual, a physician, or other healthcare professional that is in some way affiliated, you know, with the entity, either employed or some other arrangement. And therein lies the problem, because this other arrangement is not further defined, you know, in the statutes. And so, as the GAO noted, that leaves open the possibility, well, we'll just link up with the nearby local prison or other entities, and those patients or those prisoners will become our patients, as an example.
This sounds like a really sophisticated drug program. And when I say that, I don't mean program as in a plan that's been laid out. I mean like drug pushers, kind of like.
Well, it is. You know,
when you say we can't hook up, this isn't going to work over here. Let's just hook up with a prison. We'll get those guys in. That'll be no problem whatsoever.
And again, you know, it's not specifically prohibited by the law. So, you know, from a purely objective standpoint, more power to them. That's a very effective way to exploit these things. I think, you know,
exploit is a perfect term. You know,
the other concern the drug companies have is, I mentioned there's a minimum 23% discount that's pegged to the Medicaid statutorily defined rebate, but there can be other discounts on top of that. If you as a drug company have been increasing the price of your drug at a rate faster than the rate of inflation, you know, that spread also gets added to the discount. So it could be 50-60% discount when all is said and done.
Are we talking name brand or generic here?
These are primarily name brand drugs that are at the core of this. And again, a lot of these specialty biologics and the higher priced drugs are the ones that the drug companies are feeling the most pinch on.
Third category of drugs you reference is orphan drugs. Give me an idea what that is.
So an orphan drug, it's not one that nobody loves. It's one that doesn't have to have red hair or anything like that. The orphan drug is defined by the FDA as a drug that serves a very small population. And there are some, you know, some credits and some tax credits and other regulatory incentives that exist to encourage drug makers to go after these populations. As it applies to the 340B program, HRSA has ruled that if the drug is being used for those orphan indications, then there's no discount. The drug company doesn't have to, have a discount apply. However, if that same drug happens to be approved for another non-orphan indication, well, the discount then applies. And, you know, this comes into play because there are some major blockbuster drugs that do billions of dollars a year in annual sales that one of their many approved indications happens to be an orphan indication. Well, how do you make sure that the drug maker and the hospital and everyone, this is a self-policing largely, mm-hmm. A program that everyone is doing things right and recording the appropriate use. This orphan indication, it also applies to, just a handful of the facilities that are eligible under the law, not the safety net hospitals, but some of the ones that were expanded or that were granted status for 340B under the ACA.
This is definitely a kind of wink and a nod program that's going on.
Well, it is. And I guess, one other aspect just to compound it further, it has to do with contract pharmacies. Before 2010, the only way a hospital could do this is they would, be able to fulfill a prescription in their own in-house pharmacy. Prior to 2010, you could only fill a prescription inside your in-house pharmacy. That changed in 2010 when HRSA issued guidance that allowed these hospitals basically to enter into relationships with an unlimited number of pharmacies. And well, what does that mean? Well, a patient can fill a prescription anywhere they want, but if you want to capture that spread and take advantage of that discount, you as a hospital want to make sure that they fill it at a location that has some relationship with you. And so the number of these contract pharmacy arrangements has gone from maybe 2,000 or so in 2009, 2010, to more like 12,000 now. And that is one of the things that's gotten the attention of the folks in Congress. And Senator Grassley, as an example, sent a letter to the CEO of Walgreens noting that about 5,500 Walgreens facilities are now part of this. And now you're starting to wonder, well, Walgreens probably not doing this solely out of the goodness of their heart. And so there's probably a financial incentive for them. So now we're getting back to, are the proceeds, are the funds being generated by this 340B program being used for their intended purpose? Are these poor, uninsured patient populations, reaping the full benefits? Or are we starting to see maybe some other benefits accruing? And so, we think once these near-term budget issues that continually confront Congress are hopefully put behind them at the end of this calendar year, I think you'll see more attention focused in 2014. This is, again, becoming more of an issue that drug makers care about. Mm-hmm. And safety net hospitals obviously have a very vested interest in protecting the status quo and making sure the program stays in place. If anything, they'd like to see it expanded further.
Well, of course.
And so I think those are probably set to come to a head in 2014.
My gosh, this is I'm seeing an episode of The Sopranos right here in front of me with this whole thing. It sounds like protection money. It sounds like this is insane.
And
now everybody's going, Senator Grassley, shh, please, we got a good thing here.
It's just one of those things that was very well intentioned when it was created back in 1992 and has grown, I think, far beyond what anyone expected it would.
My gosh, I know you'll be back with more as 2014 rolls around and we really dive into this further to find out truly what's going on with this money. Where is it going and who is really winning and losing in this whole battle? His name is Brian Rye. The piece is called The 340B Conundrum. Affordable Care Act shrinks ranks of uninsured, boosts drug discount programs for hospitals serving them. Thank you for being here.
My pleasure.
Turns out the Federal Reserve had a reason to keep its foot on the stimulus gas pedal last month. The delayed September jobs report shows the U.S. economy wasn't producing the jobs economists had thought heading into the government shutdown. Just 148,000 jobs were created in September, fewer than the 180,000 forecast in our Bloomberg survey of economists, and not enough for the Fed to taper its bond buying program anytime soon.
You're listening to Bloomberg Government's Capital Impact on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM, and the word is out, and the word is not good. Of course, I'm talking about a delayed jobs report from the Department of Labor based on data collected before the recent government shutdown. Yes, I did say government shutdown. So many things happened during that government shutdown. I think the one thing that I heard more about than anything else was the fact that people were unable to watch the Panda Cam. which I found completely ludicrous because there were plenty of other cameras out there to watch. Here to discuss cameras and jobs and the economy and such with me now is Bloomberg Government Senior Economic Analyst, Dr. Neela Richardson. Hi, Neela.
Hi, Alan.
There was such an uproar about this panda camera. We'll talk about jobs and such, which is kind of depressing. I'm trying to lighten the mood here a little bit. One camera that I found, and I actually got to visit the studio of this camera, is the cockroach cam. Now, unfortunately, it looks like the cockroach cam is down as we pull it up right now. But the cockroach cam is really cool. It's at the Audubon Society's Insectarium in New Orleans, Louisiana. And I got to go down there and actually visit the set. Look, I don't know if you can see that from there, but it's like a little kitchen, see? And there's little roaches running around in the kitchen. And on Fridays, you can vote for the movie the roaches get to watch in the studio.
This is what happens when the government starts spending money. We go from pandas to cockroaches.
Hey, I've been there. I'm telling you, this place is pretty cool. And they got several Animal Planet cameras in there. And the fact that you can watch the cockroach cam online, that just, I was like, hey, forget pandas. We got roaches. This is good stuff.
Alan, please bring back the panda.
I tried. It was down, actually. But that aside, let's dive into some jobs numbers. The Department of Labor obviously was closed during the shutdown, so the numbers were just released, and unfortunately, they're not exactly the good numbers one would have expected. This is what I would have expected to have seen post furloughs.
Yes. So leading into the government shutdown, these numbers reflect job creation through the third quarter, unaffected by the shutdown per se.
Right.
And what we saw is that the numbers for August were revised upward from 169,000 jobs to 193,000. That was a good result.
Sure.
But the numbers for September were really disappointing. 148,000 jobs created. That's much lower than anyone in the markets expected. And the only reason why the markets are happy is because they think that such a low, lackluster jobs report would automatically mean the Federal Reserve will keep stimulating the economy through this stimulus spending and keeping interest rates very, very low.
So I see the perfect storm of, and then it's been going on since the beginning of the year. And this is the Fed trying to stimulate the economy. However, the government, by way of fiscal policy, is sabotaging it through the payroll tax, the growth in the payroll tax, the sequester, and of course now furloughs.
There is a lot of factors that are becoming headwinds to job creation in this country. And those factors aren't economic ones. And that's the curious part of this whole scenario.
Right.
There is so much cash on corporate balance sheets right now, except corporations and businesses, older firms, are unwilling or hesitant to invest and hire because of all the political uncertainty.
Right.
When you don't know if your government is going to pay its debts or not, it's very hard to invest in that climate. But these numbers themselves didn't even take into effect that debt ceiling circus and impasse. These numbers were put out before that. So it really shows how even leading into the government shutdown, there was so much political uncertainty and angst that the economy is not responding to the record low interest rates and available cash. The economy refuses to generate that innovation and research and hiring that the economy needs to grow.
Okay, so that scares me even more because you've just couched it such that this is all happening before the furloughs. What are we going to be seeing post furloughs when this delayed number comes out?
I think you're going to see a pretty disappointing, even more disappointing jobs report. But I think given this one, we're all prepared for that.
Right.
That October was pretty much a month of stagnation. What's important is what happens after October. And there is some reason for optimism. We have these budget committees who are set to reconcile the House and Senate plans and really come to an agreement on spending caps so that the government can have a budget of some sort that will give some certainty to the markets. So hopefully, if that is accomplished, we won't see a shutdown in January 15th. We won't see a debt ceiling impasse in February, and the economy will be allowed to get out of neutral and actually progress.
In theory, that sounds great. But time will tell whether this actually happens. This Congress just does not get along. And I don't see I see a round two of this come January, to be honest with you.
And that round two, if it were to occur, you can see that it will bleed into the unemployment numbers themselves. And it's also important to note that even though the unemployment rate went down from 7.3% to 7.2%, that number is quite misleading because labor force participation is also at record lows. So usually you see the unemployment rate go down and everybody's happy, woohoo, it's going down.
Right.
Now it doesn't mean anything
right.
because less people are working. I'd actually like to see that number go up if it meant that people were coming back into the jobs market, looking for jobs, increasing that unemployment rate because they think there are opportunities to be had, and we're just not seeing that now.
So let's talk a little bit, just shift gears slightly, if we could, about Janet Yellen's nomination. What does this mean? Replacing Ben Bernanke, what are we talking about here? Are they similar, or are we going to be taking a completely different approach at the Fed Reserve?
You know, there has been commentators who have said that Janet Yellen would be a continuation of Ben Bernanke's policies. And I think to a certain extent that is absolutely true because she is the vice governor at the Fed, vice chair, and she has been there throughout Bernanke's tenure. So she is very familiar with Fed policies. There's also this notion in the market that she is quote unquote a dove and will continue stimulus for a longer term than perhaps another candidate would be. Time will tell. What I see in Janet Yellen is someone who's quite independent. Mm-hmm. If you read her speeches, if you look at her writings, I think she is more motivated by economic efficiency than just a dovish view of unemployment and inflation. So the markets may be surprised by her actions in the future. Time will tell. I wouldn't suggest that she would be in lockstep with a long-term stimulus program.
She's made 22 public speeches. Of these, four have dealt with regulation and provide very clear and explicit guidance on her views. Financial industry, which is already arguing that the regulation has gone too far, should probably take note. This from a coworker, Christopher Payne, senior mm-hmm. economic analyst as well at Bloomberg Government. Pretty accurate and rings true with exactly what you just said. She's got her own voice and is going to let it be heard.
And Chris pens that voice very well. I wish he was here to itemize it. But yes, her speeches show that she is a believer in regulation. And this is a very important point because we are familiar with the twin roles of the Fed to keep inflation low and to support job creation. We understand that, full employment in the economy. But Dodd-Frank gave the Fed a new role, and that is as a systemic risk regulator. This is a role that has not been fully embraced yet because the rules, one, haven't been fully written, and two, this economy has been sidetracked by low job creation, political uncertainty, government shutdowns, debt ceiling impasses. We haven't really had the full effect of Dodd-Frank. That will change. So sometime during Janet Yellen's tenure, we are going to shift from a Fed who is completely focused on full employment to a Fed who now has to embrace its mandates under Dodd-Frank. And Janet Yellen will be leading that ship. It'll be interesting to see what direction that takes and how the market will respond.
And the number of firsts that she's also accomplished by at least getting as far as she has gotten is kind of exciting. So someone on the president's arm there who's in charge of the money.
Absolutely. It's great that the most powerful man in the universe is now a woman. I'm really excited about that fact.
Wait a minute. It sounds like my household. The most powerful person in my house is a woman who controls all the money. Is it? It's exciting.
It works for households. It should work for economies as well.
You can quote her on that. Her name is Dr. Neela Richardson, senior economic analyst with Bloomberg Government. As always, thank you so much for bringing the financial picture into reach for us.
It's great to be here with you, Alan. Thank you.
Thank you. Make sure to follow us on Twitter at BGov. Follow me at Alan L. Scott. I'll catch you again next Thursday at 11 with plenty more to say about the business impact of government actions. For BGov's Capital Impact on Federal News Radio 1500 AM, I'm Alan Scott.